Welcome to Upfront on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. I want to thank you for joining us today on the show. Now, as African countries confront the COVID-19 pandemic, they are also grappling with a mounting debt burden, which is forcing them to pay on their external debts instead of using the resources to strengthen their public healthcare systems. Now, even though the continent has been the least affected so far in terms of numbers, their economies have experienced a steep decline and stagnating growth after years of enjoying a steady economic outlook that had forecast many of them to be on a path to attaining middle-class status in the next few decades. Economists estimate Africa's foreign debt burden to lie around $500 billion, and of that, Zambia, which is the topic of our conversation today, owes around $11 billion, $3 billion of that is owed to China. And this year, Zambia's President Edgar Lungu announced that his country would not be in position to pay on its loan. A statement from Zambia spokesman Isaac Chipampe said that President Lungu called for debt relief and cancellation in light of reduced revenue due to the negative impact of the pandemic, as well as competing needs for the country to secure adequate resources to fight the pandemic and to stimulate the economy. And so now Zambia finds itself in a situation that some economists have termed as a financial limbo after failing to fulfill on their $42 million payment on one of its $3 billion sovereign bonds. And the recent G20 summit approved measures that provide a lifeline for economies saddled with debt, but that did not come in time for Zambia and other African countries that are struggling with the COVID-19 pandemic, whose economies are clearly contracting. Edwin Ikuria is the Africa Executive Director at the One Campaign. He's of the idea that if donor countries and multilateral agencies don't intervene to come up with a solution to Zambia's debt issues, it could have an impact on many other African countries that are equally facing a mounting debt burden.
Recently, the G20 struck an agreement to restructure some of the debt for some of the poorest nations, many of them in Africa. What are some of the notable details in the agreement, and how do they affect African countries like Zambia, which is the center of our conversation today?
The main issue with the agreement itself is not a problem. It's an agreement for developed countries, members of the G20, to halt debt repayment, from the poorest countries of the world, and which is basically to help them have some kind of liquidity to be able to respond to the pandemic, right? So the agreement is not anything complex. It's that you should, if you request for a debt repayment and for suspension of a debt repayment, then that is granted to you. But this is official credit. It doesn't include, creditors like the World Bank or the IMF or other multilateral, creditors like that. It doesn't include the private creditors. And the reason why this has been a major source of concern is that the share of official credit, right, or official debt, is so small compared to the rest. So the biggest part of the debt that is owned by sovereigns are from the private creditors, which is basically these bonds that they issue, Eurobond, all the bonds that they issue here and there. That is the biggest chunk of it. And then these guys are not playing in that suspension. But more importantly, the reason why the policy has been not taken up the way it should have is that once a country requests for debt standstill or for debt suspension, the international financial system does not reward them. Actually, it punishes them. It punishes them by downgrading, or basically it begins to look at you and say, this guy has a financial problem, a solvency problem, And once that outlook is there and you get a downgrade, what that means is that you're not able to get access to other markets, or you get access to other debt markets at a very high interest rate. And this is not good for them. And that is why some countries have shunned it, but many have taken it. But again, they take it because it is the only way out. When people are faced with an impossible situation, they take it. But yeah. that in itself is not good enough. So what we've been asking and calling for G20 to do is, first of all, not just the poorest country. There are some middle-income countries, like Nigeria is a lower middle-income country, you know, but they are actually...
They're struggling.
The situation is so bad,
yeah.
you know, that they also need, this kind of relief, you know, and those are the kind of things we say, expand the scope, number one, and then, include, let private creditors play in that game, let multilateral creditors play in that same space. But we're not getting that yet.
We will get to talk about some of those private lenders and the kind of pressure that would come to bear or they would need for them to play a game, to play a ball, so to say. Mm-hmm. But let's talk about Zambia. And in this case, China, which is one of its, top lenders. What has been China's general attitude about potentially restructuring or even canceling these debts? Oh, in general, why are lenders reluctant to restructure these loans?
Okay, so let's put it this way. I don't want to put all the heavy burden on China in the sense that China has been dealing with each country one after the other. They have not joined the system that enables a transparent, every eye to see exactly what is going on, how they are dealing with their own private credit or their own creditors. The sovereign creditors, right? Debtors. China has taken some steps, but the information is not out there. So we don't know. What you don't know, you really can't explain. Mm. And so that is one on one end. But the reason why it is important, the China debate is so important, is that it is one of the largest creditors on the African continent, right? And their funding is going into almost every single aspect of African economies, infrastructure-wise, particularly, right? And so the structure of those debts, the nature of those debts, the terms of those debts is not made public, And so that is the first concern. The second concern is that when China say we're going to have bilateral conversations with these sovereigns, and the rest of the world does not know, nobody understands the terms that which they are agreeing or restructuring, if they are restructuring with these countries, it makes other lenders apprehensive. Because what it means is that if we forgive you or we say, don't pay us now, we don't know if you would take that money and then pay China.
China, yes.
Understand?
Yes.
So basically, other countries will be funding China's debt. And this is the biggest concern, to talk about transparency, to talk about, that's China joining a multilateral process that puts everything on the table and everybody can see. And this is what has been the biggest challenge. The Zambia case, for instance, is that Zambia has a conversation with China, but the nature of the conversation, the nature of restructuring, and how that will affect, their access to liquidity and other things, is not in the public domain. Mm. So people don't know. And then if Zambia comes out to say, forgive my debt, or not necessarily forgive, suspend my debt because I cannot pay now. I don't have the liquidity, and the others are saying that bring everybody on board. If all of us are here in the same space, including China, then it's a lot easier to have a conversation. But if China is not in the same room with us and you're asking us to come talk about it, private creditors, that's not going to happen.
Right.
So we're not going to give you any space. And this is the situation we are facing right now.
And Zambia owes unestimated about $11 or $12 billion, and
yes,
3%. $3 billion of that apparently is owed to China. How does defaulting on these loans affect the country?
Now, that is a place we don't want to go, and it has happened, and this is where we've been really worried about, because number one, the liquidity state of the fiscal state of Zambia now, basically their access to their revenue, their capacity to generate revenue is so limited right now. Mm-hmm. And the only way to be able to get access to come out of this is to spend more. And once you don't have the money to spend, what that means is that once you have a constricted fiscal space, people do not have access to these public services. So say, for instance, a country like Nigeria cannot pay its health workers. Say we cannot pay doctors because we don't have the money to do that. You know what that means? The health system collapses, right? Because people who are sick would have to now go to private people, private service providers, and where's the money? This charge higher. And if you don't have the money, it just spirals into other sectors. So the first thing is that access to public services, becomes limited. And once that is the case, suffering just multiplies. And once you have that situation again now, like with Zambia's debt, every other investor begin to pull out their resources from the economy, right? So those who are pulling out their resources of the economy basically just create joblessness, because once there is no investment, you know, you can't create jobs. The already bad situation becomes worse. Mm-hmm. This is the situation. The case of Greece is a more recent example for us to see. You saw that it even led to massive migration, you know, and that's the kind of thing we are praying that doesn't happen on the African continent.
And protests, actually, you know, migration, but mostly I think protests and civil unrest. Yeah, in the country.
Exactly. So once suffering increases, once people begin to suffer and they can't get access to these services, of course, you know, it will lead to protests and then instability, you know. And that's so these are the situation that we've been saying this can't happen. If it happens to one country and there's nothing that is done about it, if it goes into 2, 3, 4, 5 countries, you know what that is going to be? It's just going to be, you know, global crisis.
Now, does it make sense that these countries are making debt payments when they could be putting the money or investing the money, those resources to address the pandemic?
Now, so I want to be blunt with the Zambia's case. The Zambia case was already a situation that was bad before the pandemic. The pandemic did not cause it, right? Mm. But the pandemic has made it worse. That is the situation right now. The pandemic has made it an impossible situation for the country, because here you are dealing with a humanitarian issue, dealing with a health crisis, and an economic crisis. Your people need food, need water, need all the things they need, public goods and public services. You can't provide for that. You know, it becomes very difficult to say, okay, I can't provide for these things, but I'm going to anyway pay my creditors, mm-hmm. you know? And this is what Edgar Lungu have said, that, look, I would rather take care of my people than pay my creditors. Basically, if you guys don't suspend this payment, I'm going to default. And the people have already accused him of playing to the guy, you know, trying to play a populist position.
That seems more pragmatic, you know, internally.
That's what more pragmatic. Mm. But the truth of the matter is that if he doesn't pay creditors, Zambia is going to find it very difficult down the line, because no country is going to borrow. Nobody is going to buy Zambia bonds. Zambia issue any bonds. Nobody is going to enable Zambia to issue bonds in the future. And if you don't have access to this market, you're basically just postponing. By the way, it is not a bad thing to borrow money. That's the truth. It is just that it has to be invested in the right sectors to create the right productive capacities.
Absolutely.
So,
to the next question, you know, Zambia was one of the most thriving economies on the continent. Mm-hmm. How does it find itself in this position? Where did all the money go that it borrowed? Is there an accounting for it? And is that
I don't know. I'm not in Zambia, and I'm not in the government anyway. But
if Zambia is not able to account for some of where the money went, is mm-hmm. it possible that that's one of the reasons why lenders are hesitant to even restructure their loans?
Okay, now let us be realistic. Zambia is a heavy commodity dependent economy. They thrive on copper, and maybe a little of cobalt and all the things that are used as raw materials for many other things. Mm-hmm. During this pandemic, the commodity prices crashed. There was no demand, right? Because the global economy basically went on a standstill. It's like Nigeria. There was a point where they were selling crude. For you actually pay people to take your crude. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So any economy that is dependent on commodities is suffering greatly as we speak right now, because the prices are in historic lows. So that is number one. So the source of revenue from that side is down. And that is why once you don't have a revenue inflow, there's no way you can meet your debt obligations. That is one. But number two is that when people are beginning to analyze the kind of projects that Zambia borrowed the money to do, to execute, right? And the return of that on the productive sector, you know, it's really cause to question why would we take this kind of decisions, right? Because when you go in to meet the Chinese and you ask them, you concession your mining licenses for investment in infrastructure that are not really adding value to the economy in that sense, or that would take for maybe 100 or 50 years to begin to realize the returns, it puts you in a very tough situation. And this is the you build airports. Come on, right? So that's the kind of question. Mm-hmm. Where it will work, where there is a lot of traffic, an airport – a second airport would be a great idea because it's going to increase, you know, traffic flow and all of that, and which will bring money to the economy. But when you build an airport because, you know, it's a nice thing to have, and you take a loan to build that, these are the kind of questions. How strategic were those choices?
Right. That's interesting.
Those are the kind of accounts that we are asking for. And that's why this guy has not been, the president has not been in the good books of many people in public opinion.
In case you're just joining us, this is Upfront on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. On the show with me is Edwin Ikuria, the executive director at the One Campaign. We are talking about the issue of debt relief and debt cancellation as African countries are grappling with the COVID-19 pandemic. Many of them are having to pay their loans or service their external loans, resources that are needed to respond to the pandemic.
Edwin, I know in our last conversation, we did talk about the continent-wide and some of the work that you're doing in, you know, poverty alleviation. The World Bank predicts that due to the COVID-19 global pandemic that there's going to be economic stagnation on the continent, which will result in the continent experiencing its first recession in about 25 years. Did you expect any other African countries to default on their external debts going forward?
Honestly, I'm not the one to be a prophet of doom, but it's very likely. Nigeria has gone back into a second recession in the second quarter. You know, GDP contraction in the second quarter, which basically Nigeria got into a recession in this when the numbers came out. That's Nigeria. It was in the papers recently that the federal government will not be able to pay the salaries of certain number of ministries. You see, when you're hearing those kind of numbers, you just know things are not well, right?
Yeah.
So there are several African countries right now that are struggling to meet their fiscal obligations in terms of their, keeping hospitals open, keeping schools open, paying public servants, right? And investing in the infrastructure that would help, people come out of poverty. Particularly these public services, because the reason why this is, when the World Bank predicts that about 150 million people will get into poverty again, the main reason is that the cushion for the poor is their access to public services. And when there is no access, when the public services are not functional or they are not able to function, you just deprive a whole mass of people, their livelihoods. So these are the kind of... That is the biggest challenge. So I would tell you that it is very likely that we'll see more countries get into this default situation, because when you're faced with that impossible choice of taking care of the people and then paying back your debts, you know, people are going to, you know, skin you alive if you decide to go pay debt.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you're right. And like you said, you know, the pandemic is going to drive millions of people into extreme poverty. This is something that falls within your land. What would you advise some of these African countries to do going forward? You know, we're in the middle of a pandemic. Economies, even those in the Western countries here in America, are struggling. What kind of fiscal policies would you like to see in the next couple of years to reverse some of this damage we've seen? We are going to see, at least we're still in the middle, very much in the middle of it. We don't even know the impact it's going to have on these economies.
I think, honestly, it is difficult to make a recommendation when the basket is so low, right? When the revenues coming in is so low. It's so difficult to say manage or be prudent, right? So the first thing here is to really be strategic about what is the most important investment I can make that will, you know, reflate my economy. And that's the reason why you see in the US, in the whole of Europe, right, in the UK, they're spending trillions of dollars, you know, injecting it. They're getting even more debt to spend in the economy, paying people like, you know, unemployment benefits and those kind of those social safety programs,
stimulus packages,
stimulus packages and those kind of things that are happening, because that is the only way to reflate the economy. But African countries can't afford it. That's the truth. The money simply doesn't exist. And that's the reason why you see the World at the One campaign. What we've been campaigning for is that the G20 countries, the World Bank, the rich countries should begin to think about issuing things like the SDR, the special drawing rights that the IMF usually use to create money to for situations like this exactly. So they create this money and give it to countries that need it to be able to invest back and then reflect for countries that have a balance of payment problems and countries that have, you know, dwindling foreign reserves. These SDRs would help them reflect, and this massive injection into their economy, you know, give people purchasing power to be able to do to reflect their and bring the economy back out of this. But we're not getting that traction yet, and we're hoping that that will be the next step that the G20 will take. Because otherwise, it's going to be very hard run for African countries particularly. It's going to be very, very difficult.
Absolutely. Edwin, thank you very much for speaking to us today. Always enjoy talking to you. You know, great insights. And, you know, it's, you know, tough times ahead. You know, tough times now, but tougher times ahead. Hopefully things will improve. We'll see a turnaround. You know, let's be optimistic. You don't want to be a prophet of doom, like you said. But it's hard to be optimistic in the face of what we are seeing right now. Some of the numbers do not make sense, and they don't give hope for what is happening in the next couple of months.
We continue to hope. I hope that the global leaders, you know, take the right steps. Otherwise, we're in this together.
When we have our next conversation again, we'll have much more hopeful things to talk about.
I hope so too.
Thank you, Edwin.
Thank you, Jackson.
In case you're just joining us, this is Upfront on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. This week, Ugandan presidential candidate Robert Kyagulanyi, also known as Bobi Wine, temporarily suspended his campaign after police fired rubber bullets and tear gas to prevent him from holding a rally in the eastern part of the country. The incident earlier this week is the latest in a series of deadly clashes between law enforcement and Mr. Chagulanyi's supporters. And as Ugandans prepare for the January 2021 elections, many fear that the escalating violence will have an impact on a free and fair process. And echoing those concerns are members of the Ugandan diaspora, which plays an active role in the country's politics. And this week, they held a march at the White House. And Karim Tambi, one of the organizers of the march, tells me that his group is calling on the international community to pay close attention and strongly condemn what he says is state-sponsored violence that targets the opposition.
This, like never before, has been a great revelation to Ugandans in the diaspora and their role. Honorable Kyagulanyi drew so many numbers of people in his support, and the diaspora wasn't spared. We have grown as supporters of Honorable Kyagulanyi into about 35 chapters all across the globe. We have been using social media to connect and interact and strategize. So we have three roles as Ugandans of the People Power Movement in the diaspora. The first one is to mobilize. Mobilization means we are going to look for human resource, people who have expertise on how to strategize, on how to reach out different partners in development. We also mobilize some facilitation for our comrades on the ground. We have been having so many of our comrades in hospitals and supporting the campaign as a whole. Logistically, it has been on the backs of the comrades in the diaspora too. The other one is to sensitize. Sensitization is creating general awareness and letting the world know what is going on in Uganda. Also moving the message of change to Ugandans who doubted that we could achieve change. So our message has been firm that we need a new government, and it's going to be our role as people in the diaspora to make sure that we are part of that change.
Now, the Ugandan government says that what the opposition alleges as a clampdown, police and other law enforcement trying to enforce the COVID-19 restrictions as mandated by the Electoral Commission. Is your candidate respecting these public health guidelines to avoid the spread of the coronavirus among his supporters?
Okay, I think that the government is being hypocritical. And I want the world to know that, you know, what you are seeing in Uganda is very, very hypocritical vis-a-vis what it's supposed to be doing. For starters, earlier this year, the IMF gave Uganda 491 million shillings to help during the pandemic. We also got $300 million from the World Bank. On top of that, $15 million from the State Department. So all that money has been channeled into a campaign. It hasn't been channeled into our health sector. It hasn't been channeled into providing people with masks. This campaign had been, you know, we had been told that it was going to be a scientific campaign where people will receive radios. The government had said they had gazetted some funds for providing people with, you know, means of communication. However, even masks have been politicized. It's unfortunate that unless you support Museveni, you are entitled to a mask. If you are not, you know, you are going to be looked at as somebody who is disobeying the law and somebody who is, you know, not following the SOPs. It is only the opposition that is receiving this crampdown. However, Museveni is drawing huge crowds. He's drawing huge crowds in places where he goes. We have been denied all city centers. You know, our campaign is always being diverted to take the roads that have not been, you know, worked on for 35 years. So much as the government is stopping us from reaching out to people in the town centers, we have had successes in the little villages where we have been going.
And what is it that you would like to see from the American government and other international partners? And what was it you're calling for specifically in these last protests that took place here in DC?
One of the things that we have been echoing is to stop the silence. There has been this talk in our international partners that we are watching closely what is going on in Uganda. We are monitoring closely the situation. But those are just, you know, feel-good talking points, yet our people are being murdered on ground. You cannot tell us you are monitoring us as a case study. We need action. You know, we need action. We wouldn't be here begging, but because our partners in development have facilitated what is going on in Uganda, have given Museveni the tools, you know, that he's using against his own people. That's why we came to Washington. We were at the World Bank and IMF to remind them that the money that was donated to Uganda, the money that had been loaned to Uganda earlier as a response to the pandemic has been diverted. We are also here to let the State Department know that the $15 million that had been given to Uganda earlier this year has also been wasted, and we need accountability. We need them to stand with the people of Uganda. Otherwise, we have no arms. We are here trying to see that these democratic institutions uphold to their values. We are trying to push a message to our partners in development that they cannot be silent at this moment. They cannot be silent while Ugandans are being murdered on the streets.
Karim Muntambi. Karim, thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thank you so much, Jackson.
And many thanks to all our listeners. Whether you're listening in on radio or on our podcast, I want to thank you, and I hope you enjoyed the show today. If you have any comment, remember you can drop us a line at upfront@voanews.com. Remember to check out our podcast at voanews.com. Go to the Upfront Show page. We are also on Facebook, on Instagram, and on Twitter, where you can connect with us on these social media platforms. Until next time, my name is Jackson Vunganyi. Goodbye, Africa.